one game. An NBA Finals seventh game. One game, the difference between basketball immortality and crushing disappointment. One game, a chance to become a legend, a hero, a champion.
What motivates me now more than ever is winning another championship.
It's going to take heart. It's going to take an uncanny amount of energy and strength.
To win a championship, it was one of the most emotional times of my life because that's what I play for.
One game, a chance for a legacy to grow. One final game. A season-long journey draws to a close.
Top of the world! Top of the world!
Hello, and welcome back to the Over and Back Classic NBA podcast at HarvardProxism.com. I am Jason Mann, and with me as always is Rich Kraich. Rich, glad to be with you.
Absolutely. We finally, the end of our journey of you know, breaking down these Game 7s, and we've come, like the NBA season, to the final point. The NBA Finals, and this is it's gonna be a monster kind of series of shows we're gonna do here, and I'm definitely looking forward to it though. A lot of research, a lot of work put in, and it's just good information too. I mean, what's better than a NBA Finals Game 7? Like, come on.
Yeah. So we're gonna do something a little different. We're gonna do some bite-sized looks at the Game 7s of the NBA Finals, all 18 of them. We're going to do a 8-part series, breaking down 2 or 3 each show. So. Yeah, we think it'll be interesting. It'll be kind of it'll be neat to look at. There's obviously a wide variety of games, although many of them involve the Lakers and the Celtics. So we're talking about
unfortunately,
them
lost, but that's okay. But that's gonna happen.
It's NBA history. So
it's like if we did a baseball, but we talk about the Yankees probably like 70% of the time. It just you can't. There's nothing you can do,
nothing
right?
You can do no. So you blame the Hawks for trading Bill Russell, I guess. So
right, yeah, it's all their fault, really. Yeah. It's really the St. Louis Hawks' fault.
It really is, exactly. So. So we'll be getting into that soon, but of course you can check us out on Facebook at Over and Back NBA, on Twitter at Over and Back NBA as well. You can find the Hardwood Paroxysm iTunes feed with all the with us and all the other great Podium Game podcasts that are on there. It would be great if you could leave a rating and review on iTunes. It helps people find the shows. Yeah, and
More people listening, more people interacting on Twitter, more fun, more topic requests and stuff. It's perfect.
Yeah,
just do it.
So we would
come on.
Any any feedback that we can get on what we're doing, positive or negative, we definitely appreciate it. So that's what makes the show better.
Yeah, and if you have any topic ideas, I mean, and I mentioned that sort of haphazardly, but it's true. I mean, there's been numerous shows where someone said, hey, it'd be pretty cool if you guys talked about blah, 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 and then we, like, do a little cursory research, and we're like, yeah, that would be a great show if we talked about blah, 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 or whatever. So let us, what's your blah, blah, blah?
Yeah.
Send it. We'd like to know.
Send us your blah, blah, blah. All right, well, on to the show. All right, so now we are at our number 15 choice for NBA Finals Game 7s, and I think we might ruffle some feathers with our choice here, but it is the Knicks versus the Lakers in 1970, the Knicks winning 113-99. This is most famously known as the Willis-Reed game.
Except to Walt Frazier.
Well, yeah,
he's probably okay.
Walt Frazier was pretty good in this game too, as we'll talk about. But yeah, I mean, this is, of course, I mean, it is a tremendous, courageous moment for Willis Reed, who had a torn muscle in his right thigh during Game 7, sat out Game 6, where Will Chamberlain went for 45-27. Then, gets a cortisone shot, famously emerges from the Madison Square Garden tunnel before Game 7. The fans erupt, his teammates get a lift, the Lakers are left shocked and staring, and, everyone knew at that moment that, the Knicks were going to run away with this game, apparently. But, they obviously, Reed is able to come out and play, I think, 27 minutes. He scores the first two baskets for the Knicks, doesn't score again, but is able to, use his muscle to keep Wilt from getting close to the basket for to be able to score much. He has a Wilt kind of has a rough game here. And, the Knicks are able to, blow it blow ahead early and able to hold on to win the game.
Yeah, that's absolutely. I mean, I kind of joke about it or whatever, and you know, there's the idea that, and sort of the narrative that, you know, he came out and they were just done. The Lakers had no chance or whatever. And you look at the stats. I mean, to be fair, New York did come out and just absolutely. I mean, 38 to 24 in the first quarter, and then 31 to 18 in the second. So it was really without a late rally by Los Angeles. They had 30 points to, you know, New York's 19 in the fourth. Really without that, I mean, it would have been a big blowout because they really, really jumped ahead early. And one of the big issues, and you mentioned Wilt's game, I mean, he was 1 of 11 from free throw. And that was sometimes the Wilt thing, is where, you know, those free throws just would not go down sometimes for him. Yeah. And it's just, and obviously knowing him and reading all about him and knowing, you know, it mentally, there's a lot of, I mean, that guy was not, little things would kind of get at him, and that would sort of, in a lot of ways, stop his focus or stop his concentration. It's something, and it could have been a situation where Willis Reed came out and people assumed, okay, Wilt's going to take over now, because those are a lot of times when he wasn't, when people sort of assumed things were easy for him, is when he sort of always tended to have some issues. But yeah, I mean, the free throws, I'm sure, were not a good thing either. It compounded in a lot of ways. Right. But you would sort of assume that Wilt would just lick his chops at the fact that Willis Reed was out there, you know, hobbled or whatever. But it wasn't like that at all.
He just wasn't able to take advantage of it for whatever reason. Yeah, I mean, he was 21 and 23 of the game, 21 points, 23 rebounds. But
he
was 2 for 9 on when Reed was in the floor. And, you know, and it, like I said, it was never close. So yeah, basically, you know, he was there, but not really able to, you know, help his team win. So, you know, the Lakers were aging at this point. I mean, Elgin Baylor was 35, Wilt was 33, Jerry West was 31. Wilt was actually injured 9 games in the season, but surprised everyone by returning for the playoffs.
But nobody talks about that. No.
This is the Knicks' first championship team, of course. Reed, Walt Frazier, Dave DeBuscher, Dick Barnett, and Bill Bradley is kind of the core members. They won 2 titles and made a 3rd finals in 4 years, coached by Red Holzman, of course. And Reed, this year, was the MVP of the All-Star game, the MVP of the season, and the MVP of the finals. Now, he was the first person to do that, but granted, this was the second year there was an MVP for the finals. So it's not necessarily that great of a, you know, first.
Have we ever, because I know I was trying to do it, but it's a little tough with you know, the box scores that we have. Do we know what, was he pretty deserving of that, or was it a lot of,
well, kind of fluff? Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That's
the first 3 games, I know he did really well.
Yeah,
I mean, I know game 5 he struggled a little bit, but that's,
he was injured in game 5, so he didn't play the whole game 5. He didn't play game 6.
I kind of have a hard time believing that, like, you know, because he barely played 5, didn't play 6, and then barely, you know, 2 point, but
yeah,
whatever.
I mean, he was 23-10 for the series, on, you know, 48% shooting. You know, Frazier was 17-8-10 on 54% shooting.
Okay.
All right. I mean, played all 7 games, played, you know, 43 minutes a game. So, yeah, I mean, you know, just looking at it statistically, you know, and obviously not having watched the games and not having the advantage of Dunning, all that, I mean, I think Frazier probably would have been a stronger choice, but I understand, obviously, the reason to choose Reed for it. It's fine. You know, it's not.
And then, yeah, when you get into value, I mean, a lot of times when you look at old, you know, today we sort of treat MVP awards as like the best guy, and that's rightfully so. It's probably how it should, but a lot of times, and you get that with old time baseball as well, where value was determined a little bit different than we assume. Value isn't necessarily best, and in this case there was probably some, you know, some narrative surrounding that final game,
well, there was, and him, clearly,
you know,
but
rallying them up, and I'm sure the quotes of everybody saying, yeah, he was the reason we won, I mean, it's fine, it's nitpicky.
I don't know, believe it. Yeah, I mean, I think he played well enough that, hey, I mean,
sure,
there's a reasonable case to be made, you know, even without, you know, that, you know, he's right in that conversation, so it's not like I feel like it's unfair, for sure.
No, not at all.
This was the Lakers' 7th finals loss in 9 years, although at least it was to a new team. So, I thought there was some interesting quotes from teammates regarding this from NBA.com. Frazier saying, "I saw the whole Laker team standing around staring at this man. When I saw that, when they stopped warming up, something told me we might have these guys." And Bill Bradley, in a New York Times article from 1990, said it was the best example of inspiration by an individual in a sporting event I've ever seen. When I saw Willis finally come out, I got so pumped up. I thought, he's here, he's here, he's here. And I thought, if he can fly, so can we. So, I mean, like I said, they were up 79-54 in the second half when Willis Reed finally left the game for good. And, you know, even though it got up to 14, it was practically goal. And a description from New York Daily News, which is actually the talking about how he was basically immobile. His face was contorted in pain, and often he did not jump for a rebound or go down the court, but he was there. He used his heart and his huge body to keep Chamberlain from getting close to the basket for rebounds, dunks, tips, and easy layups. I've heard, of course, everyone else talk about Willis Reed, but I don't know if I've ever actually heard him talk about it that much. But there's a column from fairly recently. I think it was actually a couple years ago when the Knicks were in the playoffs and Carmelo was hurt and somebody else was hurt. And I mean, Reed basically said, like, you know, I wouldn't have done what I did, like, if it hadn't been game seven in the finals, and if I knew that, like, I wasn't going to make anything worse. So he was like
saying
that, like, okay, yeah, this is not an example for everybody to follow. It just happened to be in the situation where I wanted to be, like, and like he was talking about how everyone got excited and everyone and people were saying everything's going to be all right. And he's like, yeah. And I thought, yeah, I'm here on one leg, you know. And talking about what he did to hide the extent of the injury, moving in slow motion, jogging stiff-legged, avoiding eye contact with Chamberlain, of all things, which is, you know, just kind of like interesting. Like, there's like, you know, everyone's kind of saying, well, the Lakers were intimidated, but that kind of sounds like Willis was intimidated a little bit, you know?
Yeah, right. Like, please hide me. Don't tell Wilt I'm here. Like, yeah, it's funny how it sort of turned. Yeah, you kind of get surprised because you would sort of assume, because this story has taken on such a legend, that the guy involved in it would be part of that legend. You know, we get that with a lot of sports. It's like a lot of reasons why these guys are, because these guys just never shut up about it sometimes. Like, it's, and Willis couldn't be. Yeah, I mean, there's a Sports Century video about him. There's a bunch of stuff. And yeah, every time they talk, he's kind of like, eh, I mean, it was what it was. Yeah. And like, but his teammates are like, no, it was the best thing ever. And like, he's like, yeah, I mean,
yeah, I mean,
like, he's the least excited about it, which is pretty funny.
Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah. And then, you know, and he was just so glad, like, he couldn't believe that he made that first shot. Like, he was just so glad it went in, and was just like,
it's a terrible, if you watch how he shoots, like, he doesn't jump, and like, it's a terrible, it just looks like a really broken shot. Yeah. Like, there's some sort of fate that put that thing in there, because like, he shoots on like the down of his jump. It's like a really fundamentally awful shot. And like, his second one is like also as fundamentally bad. And then he's like closely guarded and it goes in. And I'm sure he was just like, don't pass me the ball ever again. Like, there's no way I'm going to make two of these ever, you know? So it's funny, but yeah, that first shot is, and there's no one's anywhere near him, cause he's so slow to get down court.
Right.
That like nobody's within like 40 feet of him in that first shot, and then yeah, he just puts it up and makes it. But there was some fate that put that ball in there, but who knows? So
and of course, you know, there Walt Frazier's game seven for the ages, 36 points, 19 assists, 7 rebounds, and 5 steals. He was 12 of 17 from the field and 12 of 12 from the free throw line, and really helped bewilder Jerry West. You know, there's kind of a, when early on when the Lakers were trying to get in, like, you know, Frazier, you know, got him with the steal right away, and basically like just West, like, you know, was just like bang, you know, just really frustrated and really out of there. And that was, you know, kind of a point in which the Knicks knew they had them. DeBuscher also had 18 and 17 in the game. West did have 28-6-5, but you know, didn't get much from Frazier or Baylor in the game, Wilt and Baylor in the game, excuse me. Mm-hmm. And the Lakers would again battle in the 72-73 finals, with each team winning once. So this was a, you know, nice little rivalry in the early 70s. Anything else about this game?
No, I don't think I have anything more.
Okay.
You know, one of our famous ones, probably the most famous one we're going to talk, and I'm sure the one that people are going to say, 15? Like, what could be better than this? Or like, no, and there's a few that are obviously, you know, obviously better. But yeah, I could see a lot of people thinking this is, you know, top 10 worthy, top 5 worthy. And you know, you'll see the reason. One of the big reasons why I think, and one of the big reasons I think later, you know, we talk about, it's a famous game, but it's not really necessarily a great, you know, game seven. It's not particularly close at any point. There's not really, outside of the Willis Reed coming out of the tunnel and making the first two shots, the rest is just kind of pedestrian for a lot of ways.
I mean,
so there, you'll see. You'll
there's
see
the Frazier performance, but yeah, beyond that, like, it's, yeah, sure, it's not necessarily an enthralling game. So, Yeah. So the next choice, number 14, is the Minneapolis Lakers against the Syracuse Nationals. The Nationals eventually became the 76ers, for those who don't know. The Lakers won this game 87-80. This was the final game of George Mikan's career. He did actually have a brief comeback a couple years later, but that did not go well. But this was basically the end of his of that dynasty. They won 5 titles in 6 years in the NBA BAA, plus added another championship in the NBL, which was the league that merged with the BAA to become the NBA. The two of the best Nationals players, Dolph Schayes and Earl Lloyd, were playing in this game with Cass. And Schayes was still able to have 18-9-8. Paul Seymour and George King were kind of their other key players. In fact, all their key players are 26 and younger. They were a very young team. And Seymour, Schayes, and Al Servi, who was now the coach, had actually been on the 1950 team that lost in the finals. We talked about Earl Lloyd in a previous podcast. He's the first African American player to actually play in the NBA. He was not the first to have a contract, but they were, you know, four who essentially started around the same time, and was he and one of his teammates. I'm blanking right now on his teammate's name, but
we're bad people, but we've done a lot of shit.
It's
going to be obvious when you say it, but what was that guy's name? Damn it, we're bad.
All right. We'll edit that part out. So he was one of the first African-American players to win an NBA championship. And for the Lakers, Mikan actually didn't play that well in this game. He only had 11 points on 2 of 10 shooting. Jim Pollard stepped up, though, with 21-3-3. And 54 was a little bit odd. It was the last year before the shot clock. And it was also the year where the NBA had a very strange round-robin playoff format for one season that kind of, you know, threw a bunch of which kind of threw everybody off, but
very weird way to do it. Yeah, that's though. I'd be pretty interesting if they did it today, but probably not very good.
Mm-hmm.
No, yeah, that's it's very there's been few little tweaks to the playoff format, but by and large, it's very similar now. I mean, there's different things with home and away or whatever, but what we sort of know as the playoffs, a lot of ways really have been pretty standard for quite a while. I mean, obviously, you had a few different teams here. Seeding might be a little different, but by and large, yeah, not totally a wild, you know, sort of difference with playoff, you know, here and there. Whereas, you know, the World Series, you know, went through a lot of changes in its first, you know, few years. You know, NBA Finals, we kind of settled pretty quickly into a format that we're kind of used to today. But yeah, round robin, probably not the best move.
Yeah,
but
so they didn't stick with that one. Jim Tucker was the other first African American player to. Okay. I was looking at the wrong year for the Nationals, which is why I didn't see him on that list. So anyway, so I thought this was interesting from NBA.com. During his amateur professional career, Mikan had suffered 2 broken legs, broken bones in both feet, and fractures of his wrist, nose, thumb, and 3 fingers.
Yep, and that's why he retired when he was 30. Yes. So,
and in game 2 with 7 seconds left, Paul Seymour took a set shot from 43 feet out and swished it, giving the Nats a 62-60 win. It was the first time the Lakers had lost a playoff game in the Minneapolis Auditorium, which is a streak that extended through 7 seasons. Now, as we mentioned before, sometimes they played in St. Paul instead of Minneapolis, but it's still a pretty good streak. Let's see. Pollard scored 9 of his points in the third period when Minneapolis pulled ahead 61-45. The Nats did work their way back into it in the fourth quarter, but they fell short 87-80. So I don't think it was quite ever that close, but it was still, you know, reasonably competitive game. And sure. This was kind of a little bit end of an era for the Lakers. Obviously they were okay for a couple years, and then they kind of got really bad until they got Elgin Baylor and then ended up moving to Los Angeles. Of course, the Nationals won the 55 title and then were good. Okay. For the rest of the 50s with Schayes. And then eventually in 62, I think would move to, or 63 would move to Philadelphia. So, but they had a pretty good run there, but their best days were, Shays was obviously a superstar, one of the great players of the 50s, and they had a decent run, but of course they couldn't match up with the Celtics once they got going.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Lakers, really, really, as you said, got real bad real fast. And a lot of ways with George Mikan as the coach in some of those years. But before, obviously moving to LA and then sort of having a few rough patches, then finally getting it together and really not looking back for many, 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 many years. So I'm trying to look here. I'm looking at just to see how long it was that they took them to be, not a very good. Yeah, other than the 74-75 was a 30 win. Other than that, 50s, 40s, 60s. It's pretty remarkable run up until, we get to the late, the late 2000s Kobe era. So
yeah, absolutely.
Jerks. That's all
right. So our number 13 choice is the Rochester Royals against the New York Knicks in 51. This is an odd series because the Royals actually won the first three games, then the Knicks won the next three, and the Royals were able to win game seven of film. So it's only one, the first of three times a team has taken a 3-0 series lead and then the other team ended up forcing a game seven. This is the closest margin of those three, only 4 points. It was 79-75, the Royals winning the game. So the Royals, of course, are now the Sacramento Kings, and they have the longest NBA title drought and also the longest NBA finals appearance drought in history. So,
damn you, Robert Horry.
Yes. This apparently was a somewhat important series for raising pro basketball's profile. This was kind of, it didn't necessarily move it any to the front pages, but it was two New York teams. It was the first seven-game finals in league history. The NBA really only existed. This was only the NBA's second season once the league merged. So, everything was kind of getting its way to sort out, but it was sort of, the Royals had, Bob Davies, who was kind of a real big ball-handling star at the time. It was, I guess, the player who invented the behind-the-back pass, or at least was credited with that. And he had 23-3 in this game. Arnie Risen, who was, kind of their big man, had 24-13. Bobby Wanzer, was kind of their third star, had 13-11. And the Royals actually had future Knicks coach Red Holzman on their team as well. So
there you go.
And they were coached by Les Harrison, who led Rochester to 600 plus seasons in a row. So they were
a early dynasty of the NBA. And I think I when we were doing our blog post, which is something that we've always wanted to do a little bit more, I looked at this team, and it's a pretty fascinating team in a lot of ways. I mean, really a dominant early, we might not remember that. I mean, it's obviously, like you said, NBA and if it is in its infancy, but a pretty dominant team in the early. We just sort of assume because it's the Rochester Royals, and I don't think that ever comes to top of mind of people. But yeah, a really good team for a lot of years.
Yeah, and they kind of ran into the Lakers a lot, obviously. Mm-hmm. This was the only year they were really able to get through on the Lakers, and honestly, it was because George Mikan had a serious injury and was injured during the series, but. They still obviously had quite a bit of success. The Knicks, meanwhile, had Vince Borla, who had 16-7. Harry Gallatin had 12-10. Other notable players were Nat Clifton, Max Zaslavsky, and Dick McGuire, and they were coached by Joe Lapchick. So this game was the Royals took a big early lead, but the Knicks were able to cut it short, 74-72 with less than 2 minutes left to go. Risen drew Connie Simmons' sixth foul for the Royals. The Knicks only had a Harry Gallatin left in the front court. Risen then scored on a hook and a free throw to give Rochester a 75-74 lead. Borla tied it with a free throw, and from there the momentum shifted. Davies drove and drew a blocking foul on Dick McGuire. The Knicks argued that it should have been a charging call. Davies made both his free throws for a 77-75 lead, and the rule at the time was the team's in the final 2 minutes, the teams would have a jump ball after foul shots during that time. Right, so Rochester controlled the jump.
Momentum.
Yeah, Holzman ran out.
Killing any sort of form of momentum that could ever, or any excitement that could possibly be derived from basketball. But yeah,
and that would go away once the shot clock came into
fruition. Yes, thankfully. But,
so Rochester controlled the jump, and then Holzman ran out the clock until Jack Coleman scored at the end for the 79-75 final score. So, and this was the first of three straight finals losses for the Knicks. They were, a good team for early 50s, but by the late 50s, they would fall off quite a bit.
All right, so a quick little quiz time here. Right. How well do you know your Rochester Royals history?
Ooh, hopefully.
Basically, so, the franchise. So after Rochester, where did they go?
Cincinnati.
Cincinnati Royals. After that?
They went to Kansas City and Omaha.
There it is. All right, and then after that?
And then just Kansas City.
Yes. And then?
And then Sacramento.
There you go. Okay, so you know it quite well.
I know it reasonably well, yes.
There you go. It's always a funny team. I love the Kansas City Omaha.
Yes.
Thing that lasted for that's still to this day.
Right?
Yeah, it was like 3 years, and it always, like, I'll read it in books and I'm like, oh yeah, that's like really, you know, and we think of it, it's just so weird. I mean, it's just hard to believe that and you know, it's not that long ago that we saw it in, you know, the current NBA, you know, the New Orleans Oklahoma City Hornets.
Yeah.
for you know,
obviously extenuated circumstances there, but
sure.
Yeah.
But it's pretty funny. I wonder you're never going to see it ever again, but it's kind of fun. I think it's a pretty cool way to sort of, you know, I think honestly it wouldn't be the worst thing. I don't know if any NBA team is really, you know, really needs it, but there's some baseball teams that could probably, hey, you know, we spent half the year in Portland and the other half in, you know, Charlotte, you know, it's really bizarre.
Far,
it's
just like, yes.
Yeah, no, it's just like really bizarre, but like, yeah, you know, I like that idea of kind of two cities that like, hey, we can't really handle a full franchise. We can take half of it. Like,
yeah.
Like I just find that fascinating, but yeah, I don't think we're going to see that anymore.
Yeah,
without,
it'd be interesting for the fans, but my guess is that the players would probably hate just that. Bad thing to have happened. Yeah, Kansas.
Yeah, mid-70s NBA players really didn't have a whole lot of clout to say, like, you know what, we're not really happy with this. We should change this rule. And not a whole really healthy league at that point. So they were probably like, oh you're going to pay us. Okay, right. Yeah, that's cool. Fine. Yeah, we'll go wherever. Kansas City, we love Kansas City. That's fine. But yeah, I think today it'd be a little tough to get that through the players' union, but we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see Chris Paul will probably mention it at the at the next CBA meeting. So
it's possible. We'll see. Yeah, Kansas City and Omar are 3 hours apart, which is kind of a long. I wasn't sure how close they were, but that's a decent time to between those cities. Yeah, that would be rough. I think as a player, you know, already having to deal with that travel, you know. So.
Oh yeah, yeah. And the one team that could do it is Sacramento. Now they're building their new arena. So we're okay.
Yeah.
New public funded arena. So we're good. Yeah. We're everybody's happy.
Yeah. except for the Sacramento taxpayers.
Right, except for the taxpayers who, in 10 years, ago, wait, what?
Well, I'm sure that they, yeah, I'm sure they don't have anything else to spend money on. All right, well, that's it for this show.
What a somber way to end it. We got to figure out a better way.
Sorry, Sacramento.
Stupid publicly funded arenas.
Anyway. So
DeMarcus Cousins is solid.
Yeah, he's good. He's good.
If you can re-sign him, that'll be great.
Yeah. Oh, he's got a few years before that. All right, so we will be back with part three of our look back at game sevens in the finals coming to you soon.